Greetings. This is Tyler McFeeters with your News Gazette, dated Friday, April 17th, 2026. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with NCAA Men's Gymnastics in CU, The Hall Calls Again, story by Bob Asmussen. Legendary Illini gymnastics coach Hayasaki honored for 33-year run. Story out of Champaign. Today, athletes commit to University of Illinois teams from across the globe. Brad Underwood's men's basketball squad just made the Final Four with the help of a handful of players from overseas. They hopped on jets and enjoyed comfortable rides to the Midwest. If only it had been that easy for Yoshi Hayasaki back in the mid-1960s. Then a star gymnast at Osaka, Japan, Hayasaki agreed to join Eric Hughes' team at the University of Washington. Getting there was, well, problematic. His family couldn't afford the expense of a flight, which was prohibitive at the time, so Hayasaki settled on a cheaper option, board a cargo ship from Yokohama to Longview, Washington, about 2 hours from the Washington campus. The ship was delivering logs from Japan to Mexico. The 12-day trip did not go well. "It was a rough trip," Hayasaki said. "I got so sick. I threw up so much, I had nothing in my stomach and was still throwing up. I think it lasted 4 days. Hayasaki left his parents, brother, and two sisters in Osaka. In the harbor, as the ship pulled away, Hayasaki fought temptation. "I feel like I'm going to dive into the water and swim back," he said. On the trip, Hayasaki hoped to learn some English from the U.S. crew of the SS Idaho. No such luck. Instead, he hung out and practiced gymnastics on a small set of parallel bars. Hayasaki didn't speak English when he first arrived in the U.S. At Hughes' direction, he spent an extra year in high school, learning the language. After multiple tries to pass a test that would allow him to enroll, Hayasaki made it. "I was finally able to get into the University of Washington," Hayasaki said. The payoff came later for the school, and for Hayasaki. He won a pair of NCAA titles in the all-around and was later selected for the school's Athletic Hall of Fame. And Hayasaki's U.S. adventure led to his profession, coaching. After 3 years working as an assistant for legendary Charles Pond, Hayasaki became Illini head coach in 1974. One NCAA title, 4 Conference Coach of the Year honors, 6 Big Ten championships, 3 Olympians, and nearly 1,000 All-Americans later, Hayasaki is about to be enshrined in another Hall of Fame. On Saturday, in conjunction with the NCAA Men's Gymnastics Championships at the State Farm Center, Hayasaki, who just turned 79, is entering the College Gymnastics Association Hall of Fame. He is already a member of the USA Gymnastics Hall of Fame. "I'm very proud of what I was able to accomplish," Hayasaki said. "You look up, and you can always want to do more, but what I've done is something I feel good about." Hayasaki is part of an Illini-centric group. His former boss at Illinois, Pond, is going posthumously. And Illinois athletes Justin Spring and Abby Grossfeld, and the 1940 Illinois team, which won the second of consecutive NCAA team titles, are part of the class, too. Hayasaki will have a large cheering section during Saturday's event. Of course, wife Lisa will be there, along with oldest daughter Erica, son Casey, a former Illini team captain, daughter Mia, and daughter Megan. Erica is a journalism professor at California Irvine. Casey works for SpaceX in Texas. Mia was a golfer at Illinois and now works in North Carolina, promoting golf for kids. Megan lives in Montana. The Hayasakis have 8 grandkids. Expect a crowded Hayasaki house in southwest Champaign. More than 50 former Illinois gymnasts will be in CU for the ceremony. There is a reunion Friday night, and Hayasaki will meet them on Saturday. Good call. After seeing Hayasaki compete at the national championships in Memphis, Tennessee, Pond approached him with an idea. Come to Illinois as a member of his staff. Hayasaki visited Champaign-Urbana. "I had no idea where it was," Hayasaki said. "I met him. He gave me a tour of Huff Hall." "What did he think of the community?" "It's a lot different than Seattle," Hayasaki said. Hayasaki was determined to earn an advanced degree. Pond's offer gave him that opportunity. "It was so important for me to be able to get a master's degree and still compete, and to be able to help this Illinois team, Hayasaki said. Pond brought Hayasaki to Illinois in 1971 as a graduate assistant. What was Pond like? Charlie was a very interesting guy, very dynamic person, Hayasaki said. If not for coaching, Hayasaki said he would have likely owned business, like his father did in Japan. Oh, so close. Hayasaki dreamed of competing in the Olympics and was in position to make the Mexico City Games in 1968, but during training he tore his Achilles tendon and was unable to compete. Obviously, I felt disappointed, but it's over, he said. Once it goes, I had a different goal, to go to grad school. Those are more important things I had to do. Hayasaki attended the Olympics in Tokyo as a fan and later went to Munich in 1972 and Montreal in 1976. I always loved the Olympic Games, Hayasaki said. He served as a personal coach for Illini-turned-Olympians Dominic Minniucci in 1988, Seoul, and Justin Spring in 2008, Beijing. A long run. How did Hayasaki last 33 years as coach? Easy. Coaching, it's my passion, he said. I don't know anything else. He plays golf, well enough to teach Mia, who now beats him when they play. Obviously, the 1989 NCAA title was a highlight. Illinois edged Nebraska, which was competing at home in the Devaney Center. We had a good team, Hayasaki said. Nebraska was the powerhouse at the time. Hayasaki wasn't an immediate hit in Illinois. It took the program several seasons to move toward the top of the Big Ten. The program had a hard time landing athletes from Illinois, so Hayasaki found athletes in Brazil, Finland, and Portugal. That's how we got it started, he said. Eventually, the Illinois athletes became interested. The best story. I asked Hayasaki about the funniest moment of his 33 years at Illinois. He came up with a doozy. The guys got together, and they always do pranks, Hayasaki said. One year, the captain decided, we're going to run the campus naked. They were very secretive about it. To be clear, Hayasaki was not one of the streakers. They got caught by the police, he said. One guy got caught, and he said, we're the men's gymnastics team. We're having fun with this thing. They made the papers, but didn't get into serious trouble. They got a warning, don't do that again. How many athletes? I'd say 15 guys, Hayasaki said. Returning to the front page, the next story is University of Illinois, Cancer Center at Illinois receiving a boost. Story by Jana Wiersema out of Urbana. A local cancer research center on the University of Illinois campus has received a prestigious designation that comes with funding and opportunities to expand its impact. The Cancer Center at Illinois has been named a basic cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, U of I officials announced Thursday. Rohit Bhargava, the center's director, said that the designation comes with funding from the National Institutes of Health and also opens the door to new discoveries and partnerships with other cancer centers. The grant money obviously helps us with the infrastructure and accelerated research, but you know, it's so much more than that, so much more than the grant itself, he said. It's easier to collaborate and be part of national discussion in the country. That, for us, is actually more important. The NCI is the federal government's main agency for cancer research. The Cancer Centers program was created in 1971 as part of the National Cancer Act, with the institute describing the initiative as one of the anchors of the nation's cancer research effort. The program recognizes centers that fulfill rigorous standards for transdisciplinary, state-of-the-art research focused on developing new and better approaches to preventing, diagnosing, and treating cancer. Bhargava said that the standards keep going up every year. It's a really hard designation to get, he said. There's only one new one every few years now. There are 74 NCI-designated cancer centers across the country. This includes 8 basic laboratory cancer centers, such as the UI facility. Rather than treating patients, basic cancer centers focus on the discovery and development of innovative approaches to cancer detection, treatment, and prevention, the UI officials said. This milestone marks the first new basic cancer center designation in nearly 40 years, underscoring CCIL's national significance. U.S. Representative Nikki Budzinski, Democrat of Springfield, and Illinois' U.S. Senators Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth advocated for the designation. The Cancer Center at Illinois is one of three cancer centers in Illinois. The other two are the Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center at Northwestern University and the University of Chicago Comprehensive Cancer Center. Bhargava said that the designation is a mark of quality at the national level that makes it easier for the Cancer Center at Illinois to translate fundamental discoveries from our institution to other cancer centers and to patients eventually. The reason that is so critical is because our cancer center does not have patients, he said. We are a so-called basic cancer center, which means we really focus on research, innovation, breakthroughs that can impact patients. But without those clinical connections, without people accepting our science, it would be all that much more difficult to impact patients. The Cancer Center at Illinois was founded in 2011 by a small group of faculty who hoped to use engineering, as well as cutting-edge science and technology, to transform cancer research, the UI official said. Today, the center is a cross-disciplinary mix of engineers, biologists, behavioral scientists, chemists, and computational experts. It is comprised of more than 125 faculty members and hundreds of trainees. Among other things, the center's work includes comparative oncology. We are testing drugs, for example, to improve the lives of our pet cats and dogs that might have cancer, Bhargava said. If we can cure our pets of cancer, then those drugs are likely going to be very impactful for humans. The facility has also applied artificial intelligence to its work. This includes using AI to examine pathology samples and formulate more precise diagnoses, Bhargava said. AI can also be applied to cancer drug discovery. We have chemists who are really experts at making many, many different kinds of compounds, he said. And each compound might be, in its own right, a little bit effective towards the cancer. But if we study all those successes and failures that we have, that might show a little bit of activity but not a lot, and use AI to parse out that understanding, we design the next generation of drugs that have the chance to be much more effective. Other examples of the center's innovations include new magnetic resonance spectroscopy, imaging technology for monitoring treatment efficacy, molecular measurement technology for detecting cancer via a simple blood test, and laboratory mimics of human cancers so that personalized therapies can be developed, UI officials said. With NCI designation, the Cancer Center at Illinois will continue to accelerate interdisciplinary research and collaborative innovations that bring hope to patients and families everywhere, said Chancellor Charles L. Isbell, Jr. This achievement reflects our enduring commitment to discovery that improves lives, and we look forward to Illinois leading this life-saving work for generations to come. Turning now to national and world news, Mideast conflict, partial ceasefire in place. Israel and Lebanon agree to 10-day deal, but Hezbollah militants aren't part of agreement. Story out of Beirut, Lebanon, and the AP. A 10-day truce began in Lebanon today that could pause fighting between Israel and the Hezbollah militant group and boost attempts to extend the ceasefire between Iran, the United States, and Israel after weeks of devastating war. U.S. President Donald Trump announced the agreement as a ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon. However, Israel has not been fighting with Lebanon itself, but rather with the Iranian-backed Hezbollah militants inside the country, who are not formally part of the agreement. Barrages of gunshots rang out across Beirut as residents fired into the air just after midnight to celebrate the beginning of the truce. Displaced families began moving towards southern Lebanon and Beirut's southern suburbs, despite warnings by officials not to attempt to return to their homes until it became clear whether the ceasefire would hold. Earlier, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he agreed to the ceasefire to advance peace efforts with Lebanon, but said Israeli troops would not withdraw. Israeli forces have engaged in fierce battles with Hezbollah in the border area as they pushed into southern Lebanon to create what officials have called a security zone. Netanyahu, in his video address, said it will extend 6 miles into Lebanon. "That is where we are, and we are not leaving," he said. Hezbollah said that Israeli occupation on our land grants Lebanon and its people the right to resist it, and this matter will be determined based on how developments unfold, a stance that could complicate the ceasefire. The U.S. State Department said that according to the agreement reached between the two sides, Israel reserves the right to defend itself at any time against planned, imminent, or ongoing attacks. But otherwise, Israel will not carry out any offensive military operations against Lebanese targets, including civilian, military, and other state targets. The wording suggested Israel would maintain the freedom to strike at will, as it did in the months following the ceasefire that ended the previous war. This time, Hezbollah said it would respond to any strikes by Israel. It's unclear when the 1 million people displaced by the war will be able to safely return. Hezbollah kept firing rockets at northern Israeli towns and communities right up to the start of the ceasefire. Air raid sirens went off in some often targeted border towns less than 10 minutes before midnight. Flurry of diplomacy. The agreement came about following a meeting between Israel's and Lebanon's ambassadors in Washington, and a flurry of subsequent phone calls from Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, according to a White House official. The talks amounted to the first direct diplomatic talks between the two countries in decades. Hezbollah had opposed direct talks between Lebanon and Israel. Trump spoke Wednesday night with Netanyahu, who agreed to a ceasefire with certain terms, according to the official, who was not authorized to comment publicly and spoke on condition of anonymity. Rubio then called Lebanon's president, Joseph Aoun, who got on board. Trump then spoke with Aoun and again with Netanyahu. The State Department worked with both governments to formulate a memorandum of understanding for the truce. White House invite. Lebanon has insisted on a ceasefire to stop the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah before engaging in more talks, while vowing to commit to disarming the group. Israel and Lebanon have technically been at war since Israel was established in 1948, and Lebanon remains deeply divided over diplomatic engagement with Israel. Trump also invited the leaders of Israel and Lebanon to the White House for what he said would be the first meaningful talks between the countries since 1983. "Both sides want to see peace, and I believe that will happen quickly," Trump wrote on social media. Lebanon and Israel signed an agreement in 1983 saying Lebanon would formally recognize Israel and Israel would withdraw from Lebanon. The deal fell apart during Lebanon's civil war and was formally rescinded a year later. A Hezbollah official said the ceasefire was a result of Iran's negotiations with the U.S., in which Iran has insisted Lebanon be included in its own ceasefire, and came about through efforts by mediator Pakistan. The official spoke on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to speak publicly. Diplomatic meeting. Meanwhile, Pakistan's army chief met Thursday with Iran's parliament speaker as part of international efforts to press for an extension to a ceasefire that has paused almost 7 weeks of war between Israel, the U.S., and Iran. It was unclear whether the frantic diplomacy could lead to a lasting deal before the ceasefire ends next week. The Iran war has killed thousands of people and upended global markets by disrupting the flow of oil. Iranian state television did not provide details on the meeting between Pakistani Army General Asim Munir and Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Kalibaf, his country's chief negotiator. There was no immediate comment from Pakistan, which has become a key mediator after hosting the talks between the U.S. and Iran that authorities said helped narrow differences between the sides. The White House said any further talks regarding Iran would likely take place in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad, though no decision had been made on whether to resume negotiations. The fragile ceasefire is holding despite a U.S. naval blockade of Iranian ports and Iranian counter-threats to target regional ports across the Red Sea. Trump suggested the ceasefire could be extended. "If we're close to a deal, would I extend?" Trump said in an exchange with reporters. "Yeah, I would do that." The war has jolted markets and rattled the global economy as shipping has been cut off and airstrikes have pounded military and civilian infrastructure. Oil prices have fallen amid hopes for an end to fighting, and U.S. stocks on Wednesday surpassed records set in January. Progress report. Even as the U.S. blockade on Iranian ports and renewed Iranian threats strained the ceasefire, regional officials reported progress, telling AP the United States and Iran had an in-principle agreement to extend it to allow for more diplomacy. They spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive negotiations. But tensions simmered. The commander of Iran's Joint Military Command, Ali Abdollahi, threatened to halt trade in the region if the U.S. does not lift its naval blockade, and a newly appointed military advisor to Iranian Supreme Leader Mojtaba Khamenei said he does not support extending the ceasefire. On the next page of National and World News, Trump administration, ex-deputy surgeon general nominated for CDC chief. Story by Mike Staube, AP medical writer. President Donald Trump on Thursday nominated Erica Schwartz, a former deputy surgeon general, to be the next director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In a social media post, Trump described Schwartz as an incredibly talented and said, "She is a star." The Atlanta-based CDC, which is charged with protecting Americans from preventable health threats, has been in turmoil since Trump returned to office more than a year ago, with a succession of mostly temporary leaders. The agency is overseen by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who had promised not to change the nation's vaccination schedule. But shortly after taking office, Kennedy said he was going to investigate the childhood vaccine schedule and went on to attempt a substantial rewrite of vaccine recommendations for kids. Some of those efforts were put on hold recently by a federal judge. The administration's first pick to run the CDC was former Florida Congressman Dr. David Weldon, but his March 2025 Senate confirmation hearing was canceled an hour before it was to begin. Weldon said at the time that he'd been told not enough senators were willing to vote for him. The White House then moved on to Susan Monarez, who had been serving as the CDC's acting director. Monarez was confirmed by the Senate, but she was ousted in less than a month. Trump administration officials said she wasn't aligned with their agenda, so they terminated her. Several key CDC scientific leaders resigned in protest, saying Monarez's dismissal dashed their hopes that a CDC director would be able to guard against political meddling in the agency's scientific research and health recommendations. Since then, there's been a revolving door in agency leadership, with the short-term role of acting director being passed from one Washington-based HHS official to another. National Institutes of Health Director Jay Bhattacharya has been overseeing the CDC the past several weeks. During a House Appropriations Committee hearing Thursday, Kennedy said the new CDC team was extraordinary. "I think this new team is really going to be able to revolutionize CDC and get it back on track," he said. Schwartz holds multiple academic credentials, including both medical and law degrees. Her career has largely been spent in military uniform, including in a leadership position at the U.S. Coast Guard, where she oversaw the organization's system of 41 clinics and 150 sick bays. She later served as Deputy Surgeon General, where she helped lead uniformed medical and health professionals posted at the CDC and government health agencies that serve the general public. Schwartz could not be reached for comment. Trump also announced the appointment of Sean Slovensky, a former Walmart executive, as CDC Deputy Director and Chief Operating Officer. Dr. Jennifer Shuford, Texas Health Commissioner, was named CDC Deputy Director and Chief Medical Officer, and Dr. Sarah Brenner, a former Food and Drug Administration Administrator, was designated as a Senior Counselor for Public Health to Kennedy. Next in national and world news, Virginia tragedy, police, ex-lawmaker, wife, dead in murder-suicide. Fairfax's life career crumbled in wake of rape allegations. Story out of Annandale, Virginia, and the AP. Former Virginia Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, a rising star in the Democratic Party until a sexual assault scandal ruined his political fortunes, killed his estranged wife and then himself weeks before a judge's deadline to move out of their family home, according to police and court records. Officers called to the family's home in the Washington, D.C. suburb of Annandale early Thursday found the bodies of Fairfax, 47, and his wife, Dr. Serena Fairfax, 49, Fairfax County Police Chief Kevin Davis said. Justin Fairfax apparently fatally shot his wife in the basement before going to an upstairs bedroom and killing himself, Davis said. Their son called 911. Serena Fairfax said in court filings that they separated nearly 2 years ago and that she filed for divorce last summer. But they were still living in the same house with their two teenage children, who were both home when the deaths occurred, Davis said. A judge on March 30th told Justin Fairfax to move out by the end of April, writing, "It is clear tensions in the Fairfax home have been extremely high for an extended period of time." Serena Fairfax had testified that her husband drank daily and that his living space was littered with empty wine bottles and piles of dirty laundry. He bought a handgun in 2022 with money intended for horseback riding lessons for their children, court records showed. According to court documents, Justin Fairfax's mental and emotional health suffered after two setbacks: his unsuccessful 2013 campaign for the Democratic nomination for Attorney General, and the 2019 sexual assault scandal that ended his political career. After both, he drank heavily and withdrew from his family. But while it took about a month to recover from the first setback, he never bounced back from the second. Fairfax won the race for lieutenant governor in 2017 and seemed poised to become Virginia's second black governor 2 years later when Democratic Governor Ralph Northam faced widespread calls to resign over a racist photo in his medical school yearbook. Fairfax would have become governor if Northam had stepped down. But then two women came forward accusing Fairfax of sexually assaulting them years earlier. An aide to Democratic vice presidential nominee John Edwards said Fairfax sexually assaulted her during the Democratic National Convention in 2004. 2 days after she spoke out, another woman accused him of raping her in 2000 while they were students at Duke University. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of your News Gazette, dated Friday, April 17th, 2026. Please stay tuned.